call the Public Safety Judiciary Conference Committee to order. You hear okay? Or?
All we need is Chairman.
We're just having an abbreviated day today because members on this side, House side, have to leave at 4:30. So we'll be meeting. Can't hear. Not everyone can hear Representative Smith. To fix the sound. So we'll be adjourning today at 4:30. We're not obviously not taking any votes today on anything. It's an opportunity for members of the conference committee to ask questions of public safety, the fire marshal, taking up the gambling and alcohol enforcement board, and Office of Justice Programs, the 911 Emergency Services Armor. And tomorrow we'll take up the Department of Corrections, some guidelines, and the Post Board, the Private Detective Board, and the Human Rights Commission. We will be meeting, we will be then recessing until 7 o'clock, and then we will be, the working group will reconvene at 7 o'clock to discuss more of the policy bills. So with that, we'll start with public safety. We've already gone through the spreadsheet, so I don't think that we need to revisit any of those line items unless members have questions. But I would suggest that you take the spreadsheet out, and you can see the differences between the House and the Senate. And but just entertain any questions that you would have, and we'll have the appropriate people come to testify.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I think members have all gotten a new copy of the side-by-side for Article 1 as well, so those contain the appropriations and various pieces of language that go with the appropriations, so that you might give us a framework to work with as well. Mr. Chair, I just started on the public safety section, and the first thing that I wondered about is your item on R11 of Article 1, setting in place a working group for issues related to crime labs and strike forces. And understand that Anoka County, the three counties in the northern suburbs, have a project in the bonding bill for a new crime lab. So I don't know if the is there somebody here from Anoka County to talk about that? And
look like
maybe somebody will come in later, but at some point I'd like to talk about that issue.
Chair.
Mr. Policy.
Senator Higgins, I heard the bill on the bonding part of it. It's a three-county deal with labs and so forth, and we intend, by and large, to add on to the same other items other than just the lab part of it. I think if I heard right yesterday why that you want to take a look at that because of the implications of having big lab in Anoka and another one in St. Paul, another one in Minneapolis, and then the BCA, it seems to me that we've got duplication in there.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins,
was your thinking on this that the Anoka County collaboration would not go forward because of this language? Were you not tracking with their proposal?
I was tracking, and we had some discussion when the bonding bill came up, and This was really the compromise that we reached, Representative Tingelstadt, who about this. We didn't want to stop the project. On the other hand, I think that we're setting a precedent here if we go ahead and fund the project without having additional information. Some of the members here will remember that we had this debate relative to police and fire training centers some years back, and we set up a task force or a working group much like this to explore where we should have those training centers regionally. My fear is that if we don't do that with the forensic labs and the crime strike task forces, we will have a proliferation of these all over the metropolitan area in greater Minnesota. And I would submit to you that those, once they're created and established, they will be coming here for state funding. And we have to decide what our priorities are and geographically where it makes most sense. It may indeed be that Anoka County, with their collaboration, that may be an appropriate place for a forensic lab. But it seems to me until we have a working group to look at that we would be making a mistake to fund it. So this is an etch. And that's the intent behind the plan. Senator Higgins, if there's ways to make it... I'm open to some language if you have something that would work in concert with the project, but I fear that, but I guess I'm open to some language.
Mr. Chair, I just worry that the left hand and the right hand would be in conflict with the bonding bill authorizing funding and then this committee saying, no, you can't. And so... I didn't know that there was a piece in the bonding bill until today, and former Senator Dave Johnson was talking to me about it, and if you would like to hear from Anoka County, he could do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the conference committee. My name is Dave Johnson. I represent Anoka County, and I think our concern with the House position is that in the bonding bill, in both in the House and the Senate, there's a provision to start work on a forensic lab for Anoka, Sherburne, and Wright counties. To make it clear, they have supported the 20 additional forensic scientists at the BCA, but their concern is right now they're putting in about 10% of the forensic evidence that they actually have because of the backlog, and they see that increasing over time. And so both the House and the Senate passed a bill putting some money in the bonding bill to deal with that, and our concern is that this provision is kind of a conflict of laws provision, you know, in the sense that in one bill it's saying that the state's authorizing it, and in this bill it says it can't be spent until until the BCA completes the study. So I think that's part of our concern. I know that the Anoka County Sheriff has additional concerns relating to the makeup, if they're actually going to look at the broader question of regional versus a one-stop shop, for lack of a better term, for a forensic lab, that there's a representative makeup of stakeholders. So I know the county would appreciate the opportunity to work with the House author and the House and Senate conferees to work through these issues.
That would be fine. Mr. Carger, I don't know if you know the answer to this. If the capital investment bill, as approved, assuming it's signed by the governor, when does that money have to be spent for individual projects? Is there? I'm just trying to understand if there is a conflict here.
Mr. Chair, I know they would issue bonds for the project, and once the bonds are released, then they would have the authority to spend it. But I do not know. I think you might need an attorney maybe to interpret this, if there would be a conflict here.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is we often have, items in the bonding bill, and communities or projects don't spend their money the first year or the second year, and that money stays there. It's not like it comes back. So that's, I guess... Mr. Johnson, I'm happy to work with you. I think you understand what some of our issues were, and I'm happy to get work with you.
Yeah, I would appreciate that opportunity. And it sounds like that it's more concerned with just moving forward, and so we look forward to working with you on that. Just for some background, in the bonding bill, there are some cash provisions, and these are actually cash provisions for the Anoka County facility, and they're planning to break ground, I believe, in September or October. So... in terms of financing the overall facility, knowing what's going on is important. So, thank you. And if there are no other questions, I look forward to working with you.
And as a quick, the superintendent might want to weigh in.
Please, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to give you... Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I just wanted to respond to what Mr. Johnson said. I'm in agreement with him. There's no issue there, but I just want to tell you from the BCA's perspective on this, I have met with Sheriff Stanek, with Sheriff Anderson, a few times with Bruce up in Anoka County. In fact, tomorrow morning, or tomorrow lunchtime, the Commissioner of Public Safety and myself and some others are meeting with him again about this particular issue. I met with Chief Dolan and Chief Arrington, and some of the outstate sheriffs about the future of the BCA laboratory and where we're going, and we testified in earlier committee about there's, I think, the sharing of information and the advancements in forensic technology are the two big boom areas in law enforcement that are going to be here for a long time. And what we've all agreed on is we just want to do it smart. We need to, I think, set up a system, and I think the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board that was created last year by the legislature would be the appropriate vehicle to accomplish this. But we want consistency, we want protocols, we want training, we want certification. We'd like to not compete with each other and end up with some counties that have and some counties that don't in terms of their ability to solve violent crimes, for example, with DNA. So what I've asked each of these law enforcement leaders to do, and they've been very receptive to this, is let's sit down and figure this out and do it in a way that there's a statewide approach to this. And we don't compete with each other. That at worst, we complement each other, and at best, we actually collaborate. And I'm not opposed. There may be 10 labs around Minnesota in a couple years from now. That might be the right approach. You know, we did it with the Bemidji lab, and that has increased our service load in northern Minnesota. Provided you the information before about the increase in the amount of evidence. But we are meeting about this, and I just wanted to assure you that we're all at the table and trying to figure out the best way to proceed.
Mr. O'Malley, I appreciate that. So does the language in the bill, is that in conflict with what you're suggesting? I mean, it seems to me that what we have here in this section of the bill is exactly what you're stating.
Yeah, I don't know when the money would have to be spent. I guess that's...
Mr. O'Malley, I wasn't asking about the money. I'm just asking about the strategy of sitting down and figuring out both in terms of crime strike task forces as well as forensic labs. Are you okay with the language that's in this bill?
Yes.
And then I'll work with Mr. Johnson on the Anoka County provision to see if there's any language that would that be satisfactory.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I think the sentence that starts on 6.4, the legislature may not authorize or fund new regional forensic crime labs until after the working group is done. That's the piece that I think could make Anoka County problematic if indeed they're ready to break ground this fall. So maybe we should just flag that and make sure that it can still work with Anoka County. Could I ask a question, Superintendent?
Okay.
The scientists that we are probably funding in our bills when we get all done. I know that there was there's a large backlog at the lab. Do you envision these 19 or 20 scientists as being able to cover the future work that's coming in, or is this only kind of going to catch us up with the backlog?
Mr. O'Malley.
Chair and members, I try to answer yes or no as often as I can.
It's a hard one to try to do that.
Well, it is, because it's not as simple as just scientist time at the bench equals shorter turnaround time. And I don't know how much longer we did it at the committee hearings, but there are a lot of factors that affect turnaround time. Robotics, for example, and we gave some examples in narcotics where business practice changes have resulted in greater turnaround time, even though we have more evidence coming in. There are new techniques always, scientifically. We may get to the point where the cop on the street can pick up a cup and throw a gum in there and shake it and get the DNA in 5 minutes. I don't know what's next coming up forensically. We've already seen DNA go from taking months down to 7 days. And new processes are always being developed. Is staffing a key element of that? Absolutely. And the 20 scientists, that's a reasonable number that we can bring them on promptly, we can train them, we can get them at the bench, and in 2 years, this is going to be an ongoing process of seeing where we're at. If we can continue with some of the changes that are on the horizon, and if they end up being true, then maybe we won't need more. We may come back in 2 years after this group meets and say, here's how we can do it better, I think.
So let's just say that we grant Anoka County the authority to establish this forensic lab. So that it would not be under the auspices of the BCA. It would be an independent entity in Anoka County. I'm assuming that they're scientists, that they would come to the state for additional scientists, and is that something that you would support?
I'm sorry, I don't understand. They would come to the BCA, you mean?
Well, I would assume they'd be coming to the state legislature for funding for their scientists. Is that not correct? Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, sorry. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Dave Johnson again. Actually, we think that's one of the advantages. We're just asking for a one-time capital expenditure, and after that, we'll self-fund all the forensic labs and then work within the region. So we're not going to be back here looking for operations costs. And we do see, just to kind of reinforce what the other speaker is saying, is a complementary role in working together. Traditionally, the sheriffs have worked well with the BCA. They see it as working collaboratively in the future. And as I mentioned earlier, they've been supportive of the BCA's request because the need is just that overwhelming.
So, Mr. Johnson, just want to be clear now. So you're saying on the record that if Anoka County, if we establish a forensic lab in Anoka County, that lab will not be coming to the state legislature for operating expenses?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, and that's what my client has told me to say. I will get and you all know I'm easy to find if that changes, but I can get a letter from the sheriff. I mean, that's the representation we've made throughout this process. I'll be more than happy to get that in writing for the committee from the sheriff, right from the horse's mouth, because we do see, and there's a joint powers agreement in the process being drafted where these three counties, Sherburn, Wright, and Anoka, share these costs among themselves.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, is the medical examiner going to have an office at that location or other things besides a lab?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, you know, I don't have the answer to that question. She has a pension problem I've been working on, but I don't know if Lona Schreiber, who works with the county, would now have more information about who else is going to be housed in the overall facility. I don't have the answer to that, but I can get it for you.
Representative Liebling?
Yes, Lona's there.
Do you want to respond?
Members, my name is Lona Schreiber. I'm the intergovernmental coordinator for Anoka County. The medical examiner services is not going to be housed in the same facility, but we do provide medical examiner services to 11 counties now under a joint powers agreement as well. This will be a training facility that the sheriff is planning to build in this new site on Bunker Road. Bunker Boulevard, and it will include the lab component. I hope that answers your question, Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman and Mrs. Schreiber, what all will be at that location?
Ms. Schreiber.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have my folder, my file in front of you. I think we can provide you the handouts that we provided the other committees on bonding.
Mr. John.
Mr. Chair, members, it's going to provide a complete law enforcement center. It's going to have the sheriff's offices. I think it's going to have a jail facility. It's going to have some of the other things he needs administratively because of the size of the county and the growing there. And then one part of it will be a forensic lab, and we're only asking that the state participate with respect to the forensic lab piece.
Representative Liebling. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator, did you have another question?
Just a last question. Based on what you know, is this project going to go on if you don't get the bonding money for the lab? Is this going to be a law enforcement center and going to contain a variety of places, as Ms. Schreiber indicated?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, I believe that the other components of the law enforcement facility are going to go on. It'll just be a question of whether they're going to have the forensic lab or not.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to say, it's really hard for me to imagine how having satellite labs or, you know, having other forensic labs around the state is going to be more efficient overall. But my question really is, what are other states doing? I mean, is there usually in most states a centralized forensic lab, or do other states have these several labs? Either of you could answer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, states do it in a wide variety of ways. I just came back actually 2 weeks ago from a conference that involves my counterparts in the other states, and this was a very, this infusion centers were the two big topics that we spent hours discussing. Sharing of intelligence information in the fusion centers and terrorism and so on, and then also the forensic. There are a number of different approaches. Some are outsourcing more, and they're finding that to be near disastrous, according to them, that it's not working as well going to private labs. Some have individual counties or cities that have their own lab, and they're completely independent. Others are in joint powers agreements so that they have, for example, one salary range. Because what I would like to try and avoid, and Sheriff Anderson and I have talked about this, and what Mr. Jensen is very consistent. Sheriff Anderson is a very credible and honorable man. He has told me that they're not going to come and try to get funding from the state. But what I told him is I'm concerned that if a county can afford to pay their scientists a little bit more, we will be the training ground, and then they'll go and take a $10,000 or $15,000, and that's going to hurt the state overall, I think. And what I would like to see is this Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board meet and discuss all of this. Every lab in the state, maybe we'd come back in a year and say our recommendation is that any lab that does forensic evidence that may end up in court in Minnesota has to be ASCLAD certified, and I know that's their plan. Minneapolis has a laboratory now, and they took one of our DNA scientists from us, which is fine, and that person's working over there. We helped train that person. They have a fingerprint technician that spent almost a year at the BCA and is now working on Minneapolis cases over there. And part of what I talked to the sheriffs and the chiefs about is as we plan for the future, one option I've given all of them is to have a person from there who would focus only on their cases, funded by them, work in the BCA lab for a year or two to understand our protocols and our training, and that would help build the relationship and set the foundation for a wiser future. Again, I'm not sure that's going to mean 10 or 12 labs or whether it means we go to one and use couriers or mail or somehow more efficiently. I'm not sure what that's going to be. But one thing we're also doing in assessing that is looking at our Bemidji Regional Lab. Now, it's been up for a while, and comparing the evidence we get from chiefs and sheriffs up there compared to what we used to get. How big a deal is it that we're 3 or 4 hours away versus in the backyard? Those are some of the things that we just don't have the answers for right now.
Joe O'Malley, you brought up Minneapolis. Does Sheriff Stanek have a lab in Hennepin County?
Yes. I'm sorry, I meant Hennepin County. When I said Minneapolis, I was thinking of Sheriff Stanek and going back to Commander Stanek in my mind. But yes, they have a laboratory in Hennepin County that has a DNA function, has a fingerprint function.
And is the city of Minneapolis going to use the Hennepin County lab, or are they going to create their own lab?
No, I met with Sheriff Stanek last week, and he and I and Chief Doerner are supposed to meet this week, because a few weeks ago when I talked to all of them about this, Chief Doerner indicated that he wanted to put two people in our lab. And I met with Assistant Chief Worcester probably a couple weeks ago, and we are in the process of putting together the funding and the agreement so that they could be state employees and operate under, for ASCLAD purposes and all these other purposes, They would come and work in the BCA lab that would be able to set priorities based on what it is that they need in Minneapolis now. For example, if they have a neighborhood and they've decided we want to really focus on some other level of crime, burglaries in which DNA could be used, and we normally can't get to that as soon, they would have a position that's funded by their city or their county, and then they could prioritize that a little bit higher. And we do that for a year or two and see what the effect is.
Any other questions on this matter?
Mr. Chair, maybe I should know this, but if a county, let's say Rice County, sends stuff to you for forensic analysis, do you charge back for them to them?
No, we do not. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, no, we do not. We don't charge for any of our services.
So then,
Senator Neville,
Mr. Johnson, what's the incentive? Is it just that you're getting such slow turnaround, or is that why you want
well,
to have a
yeah, summit? Mr. Chairman, I would, and Senator Neville, what I characterize it as is just the overwhelming amount of evidence. The BCA, the examples that the sheriff gave in committee are that they have about roughly 7,000 pieces of evidence in forensic evidence in Anoka County a year, and they submit 700. It's not anything because of what the BCA is or isn't doing as much as it is, you know, people are expecting more, and as technology increases, there are all these tools available and the expectations of the citizens in terms of, you know, how the evidence is dealt with. And so it has more to do with just the tremendous amount of evidence, why they started looking at this approach. Because if, you know, I think the sheriff sense, and if the committee wishes, I could get the sheriff here to talk more about these issues because he's the expert on this. But my understanding of it from talking to him is that his belief is that if that's what it is in Anoka County and that's what Sherburne and Wright are facing, that it's probably not just limited to those three counties, even though they're three of the faster-growing counties in the state.
All right. Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question, but I'd like to comment, and that is a couple of things. We've been hearing some testimony about the need for additional forensic capability. I don't think that's new. We've all heard that. We've also heard Chairman Paymar describe very succinctly the position of the House Committee on the language that is before us that was called into question. The House Committee did see the need for authorizing the funding, but only after a working group was formed in conjunction with the Commissioner. And Chairman Paymar suggested that this would be a way for the committees charged with public safety to command and control the money and down the road as well. I think I see two issues that this Coffers Committee is going to have to deal with, not the testimony and the need and so forth, but the language on that was pointed out on 6.4, etc., if it in some way conflicts with the bonding... capital investment bonding bill, then we probably have two issues before us. Number one, does that language conflict? If the legislature passes this language and also the bonding bill, does that conflict? And secondly, then I think we as the two legislative committees in conference who are charged with public safety, the House Public Safety Committee and the Senate one, we have to decide whether we want to adopt this language. The House already has, that it is charged with the with doing what it has done. And as a practical matter, we might also consider the life expectancy of the work product of this conference committee compared with the bonding bill, and which probably has a greater life expectancy, and I would suggest I would support this language. When the time comes, I'd like to support this language, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Anything else on this matter? Thank you all for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
I'm going to wave his name.
Yeah, we're still on public safety. We have people here that can testify on any of the items that either are in House or the Senate bill. From Homeland Security, if there's any issues there, if I don't see any here. If there's no questions, if there's questions about disaster assistance, the state match is not in the Senate bill, it's in the House bill. Pandemic flu, I texted on this the other day, that we are funding a staff person here. I would like to suggest that that be ongoing funding rather than one-time funding. But we'll have to work that out. I know that DPS would prefer that that be ongoing funding for this staff liaison person for the flu pandemic flu preparation. Senator
Wilson. Mr. Chair, I believe, too, we talked about getting current figures of other pandemic flu appropriations from the other committees to see what they are doing in that area.
Did we, Mr. Carver? Senator Rosen had asked for information about the appropriations in other bills, and I think we thought $4 to $6 million in the Health and Human Services bill. But can we get the exact numbers at some point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we forgot about that number. We will try to get that. I think you also had a question about the 05 or the 06 appropriation, and for 07, you know, for fiscal year 07, and I believe, and DPS can correct me if I'm wrong, that was $5 million last year for the flu, and of that amount, $2.9 million went to DPS, or the Department of Public Safety.
There's also some discussion, at least on the House side, about a $20 million grant that the University of Minnesota received to deal with issues of the pandemic flu, and I'm not exactly sure what all of that money is to be used for. Maybe we can find that out, too. Do you have some... I guess we can find out. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris. I am the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Actually, the appropriations bill, the omnibus appropriations bill for the Department of Health this year is different on the House and the Senate side. Currently, the House has $6,035,000 for planning, preparedness, and response activities, one-time funding. The Senate has restricted its one-time funding for antiviral with $2.183 million. And for stockpiling supplies such as ventilators, respirators at $2.182 million, with $500,000 going to local public health and $115,000 to the Department of Health for planning laboratory and epidemiology planning. The funding for the Department of Health this year, if it goes to the Senate side, which they feel is probably more likely to go to the restricted part of the Senate bill, will not be able to pass any of the money to the Department of Public Safety, and we, therefore, will also not be able to pass any through local government, which is what we did with the $2.9 million this past year. The grant for the University of Minnesota is actually to conduct a study of vaccine for the avian influenza. That is really no different than studying bovine tuberculosis or stem cell research. It's not a grant that can be used by state or local government to do preparedness planning, which is why we have requested that we at least have one full-time equivalent and an ongoing fund for in our base for Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
Any questions of the witness? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Okay. If there's nothing else under pandemic flu, why don't we move on to CRIMNET and... is there somebody here from CRIMNET who good? You presented, obviously, to both committees. I think we all understand what CRIMNET is. We don't, the investment that we've made in CRIMNET, the investment I think that we hope to continue in making sure that it's completed, and I guess I would open it up for questions. I you obviously, Mr. Good, know that the Senate and the House have different funding levels, significantly down from the governor's recommendations, and I guess my only question to you is that we're trying to get at what the priority items that you had in your request, whether you can meet those priorities given the level of funding that we have for lifespan and for e-charging and some of the other priority items you have.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dale Good. I'm the Executive Director of the CRIMET program at the BCA. Of the original, the amount recommended by the governor, $5.4 million, was for live scan replacement. So that is, that is a fundamental priority. Those live scan units were purchased under Katie's law, the 2000-2001 period of time. They've reached the end of their useful life. The new units, in addition to replacing that functionality, also provide for capturing palm prints, which enhances the latent, the crime scene print processing capability that we're currently implementing. I just want to give you a visual of the increase in the fingerprint submission, why this is so important. I have copies if it's any part of it. This is just a visual of the increase in the number of fingerprints from 1997 to 2007. It's gone up 242%. If the state did not provide live scan equipment, we would be back to cards and hours and months of backlog, hours of processing and months of backlog. So we absolutely have to have the live scan. Having said that, I guess I should preface this with, while maybe we were a bit disappointed with the difference between the governor's recommendation and what the House and the Senate are recommending, we understand the difficulty of you having to make some tough choices. What we would want to do is, to the extent that there are some funds remaining after the lifespan purchase, and to use those base funds, if it's the House position, to use those base funds to continue to work towards those core priorities. What that would do is slow us down. It's the iron triangle of information systems. The amount you spend, the functionality that you accomplish, and the amount of time it takes to complete. You can have two, but you can't have all three. So if we have less funding, we reduce the functionality, or we slow down how soon we deliver. That's really where we're at.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Good, so your priority would be live scan over e-charging?
Mr. Good.
Our priority, we have to replace those live scan units.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Good, the e-charging, how much of that can just be done by an encrypted email?
Senator Higgins, it's really quite a bit more than that. It's the ability to electronically sign. We're right now having conversations with the public defenders, with the courts, about what would satisfy an electronic signature, what meets the test, the oath of affirmation of the prosecutors, the law enforcement officers that are bringing the charges. So there's really more technology to it than secure email. It's really, in technical terms, it's workflow technology, which is, that's not just email.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Glass or Mr. Beeble can answer, but haven't we worked through at the legislature the issues of electronic signatures for, like, years? Don't we have a standard and something in place for how you put together an electronic signature? It seems to me Senator Lanham worked through that years ago. Are there things involved in the e-charging that are different from the electronic signature issues that corporations and other governmental units have been working through for years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, my recollection is the legislature adopted language that permits electronic signatures in commercial transactions and in state transactions. There had been a whole effort under the Secretary of State's office to specify all that, and my belief is there is nothing currently in place within the state for electronic signatures. So what we are doing is working with the courts, prosecutors, public defenders, and law enforcement to try to say what would satisfy, for the purposes of a criminal complaint and the affirmation process, that the law enforcement officer is affirming, you know, the probable cause statement. So we're trying to work through what's satisfactory. Anywhere from the lowest common denominator, which could be just the fact that we have a user ID and a password, to a fingerprint of that person, to a PKI digital signature. There's a whole range of electronic signature options, and we're trying to take what's the minimal that we can use that still meets the legal test in the criminal justice process. So I don't have that final answer to you, but our estimates are based on the technology that it takes to move that information from the law enforcement record system, the incident information, the incident narrative, any supporting electronic documents, to the prosecutor. The prosecutor then can perfect the complaint, obtain the affirmation from the law enforcement officer, obtain the electronic signature, and move it to the courts.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Good, what are other states doing? Are you able to use their work in coming up with these things, or are you leading the states in this work?
We're leading the states. We understand that, I can't remember the name of the county, but it's Atlanta, whatever the county name is for Atlanta, is doing some,
Fulton
County, is doing some criminal e-charging. Colorado is doing full e-charging in its civil business, but not on the criminal end. Statewide, they're doing, you know, and we are in contact with them. So we're looking at how they're doing that when we do our own estimates and our own planning.
Thank you.
Mr. Good, just so I understand, so you would need $5.4 million to do the live scan.
Correct.
Then for e-learning, you would need $1.6 million.
But the e-charging was 1.6 in our estimate, yes.
And your other key priority that you would like for the biennium would be what?
What we're trying to, again, kind of backing up in a big picture, what we're trying to accomplish is, and you recall, when the investment that the legislature has made to this point has allowed us to fill gaps in information. So where we didn't have electronic fingerprint capture, we didn't have a predatory offender database, we didn't have a booking database, we didn't have statewide court information, we didn't have probation detention release. We filled those with separate databases. Now what we're trying to do, the next priority, is to try to intelligently link that information and deliver it back to, whether it's a law enforcement officer in a squad car, or it's a investigator in a back room, or it's a judge in an arraignment appearance, to deliver that based on the information they need to know at that point in time. That's really the nuts and bolts of the...
And is that the criminal justice reporting system then?
No, that's the capture and delivery. It's the security component. It's the name event index service. It's those pieces of additional work that would allow us to do that.
And the federal funding that you have for this is how much over the biennium?
Federal funding is, we have, my recollection is we have a federal fiscal 06-05 and a federal fiscal 06 congressional earmark, and they're each about $493,000. And the FY05 has already been allocated.
I'm sorry, Mr. Dick, could you say that again?
The FY05 has been, by our policy group, has been allocated to the Cyberverse project, that $493,000. Gary, do you have different...
Excuse me, Mr. Good, you were saying the federal... We have a document here for federal fund summary that says CRIMNET for 07 is $615,000.
and then estimated OAF revenues are $665,000. And I believe with the criminal justice information systems, don't they receive at least 25% from burn grants? But maybe it's not specifically for CrimNet, but I thought there was at one time.
I don't believe there's no more burn. There has been some continued NCHIP, and those NCHIP, National Criminal History Improvement, some of that NCHIP money, I'll read that. Stand over here a little bit.
Basically, there'll be no burn.
Burn's gone, yep.
Okay, Mr. Good, I think you could, I mean, you understand the predicament we're facing, and we're all looking to see what our actual budget will be later in the week here. It would be helpful if you could outline to us, given the expected positions in the House and the Senate, what the three priorities are, and break those out a little bit clearer for us so we know what you absolutely can live with, given the circumstances. That would be helpful for us. You know, if we had the $15 million that the governor recommended, we would do it. I don't know that we do. So I would just ask that if you could provide that to the committee, that would be helpful. Other questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Good, how solid are your numbers? I always get kind of hung up in the millions, and I know we deal with billions around here, but I still get hung up in, you say you need $1.6 million for e-charging. Can you do it with $1.2? Can you do it with a million? Where did that money actually go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we have detailed spreadsheets of the hardware, software, professional technical services, and that we have that. That was a public document that was submitted to our policy group. So there's an extensive planning document, line item planning document. I think staff here, I believe, has a copy of this. So we are, and we've also submitted it to the Office of Enterprise Technology. We are very confident in the numbers that we've submitted, based on the scope of what we promised.
Thank you.
So you could just ask for one more comment, then we should probably move on if there's not questions. We also have the language, at least in the House bill, that would require that criminal and juvenile justice information policy group study sources for alternative funding. I think you probably heard testimony relative to that. So is this something that you can be supportive of, and do you think that there's some opportunities to come back to the legislature with some ideas for alternative funding based on what other states are doing?
Mr. Chair, absolutely we'll support that. You know, I recall 2002, maybe 2003, Representative Wagenius, in trying to support CrimNet, had an initiative to do bonding and there was, my recollection is, it was really bond council that said you can't bond for technology. So over the years, we have looked at alternative funding sources. But yes, can we relook at that again? Absolutely.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Good, Mr. O'Malley. Should we move on then? We want to, we have Mr. O'Malley here. We've talked about the BCA scientists. At this point, we have 20 in the Senate, 19 in the House. Do we need to have any more discussion about the BCA scientists? Senator Rosa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was that your recommendation?
I'm sorry.
Was that the recommendation from the BCA? With 20 scientists?
20.
20.
Yes. Were there any questions about line item 105, the mentoring programs, the criminal background checks?
Mr. Chair, if I remember right, the background checks at the BCA are about $8 or $4, depending on what type of check they do. But I guess the piece I'm missing is, how many mentors are we talking about having to get a background check for, and how far will this go?
Someone that can answer that question. You could introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Mayan Kapanke with the Mentoring Partnership of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we represent about 400 mentor programs across the state, and this was an issue that they had brought up that they hoped that we could help them with. And it's hard to tell how many new mentors would come into the mix with the 400 programs. There are currently programs that operate that do not do background checks, and generally those are programs that work within a supervised setting, so the kids and the mentors don't have one-on-one time alone. But part of best practices of any mentoring program is to make sure that if you are working with a child in a mentoring program, that you ought to do background checks. It's one of the safeguards that we see are very valuable to make sure that the children and the mentors are protected in their relationship. So it is hard to tell how many new mentors would come into the mix, but we made an estimate of 40,000 this year over the biennium, and we hope to evaluate that after the biennium if we are able to get some funding for that. So it could be less
than mentors?
40,000 background checks, and that would be state background checks at $8 a piece.
Times 8.
I believe through the BCA, if you are a nonprofit, that the charge is $8, and then it's $15 for for-profit agencies.
Senator Higgins.
So the $50,000 that the House has got is a good first step. But what you're really looking for is like $320,000 to do those 40,000 people?
That is correct, over the biennium, plus the $10,000 to do the appropriate training with the mentor programs to help them understand the information that they're getting, and to help them also follow fair information practices that are very valuable.
The mentoring, I admire greatly people who work with young kids, and we have a lot of mentors around the Capitol. A lot of people have come up to me and said, I'm a mentor. I work with, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, or whatever, and how important what we do for mentoring is. It's sort of hard to think about an $8 charge that gets in the way of things. But when you add them up to 40,000 $8 charges, it's a lot of money. And so, something to look for. Ms. Kapanke, do any of the organizations tell you that getting this background check is prohibitive of people becoming mentors? Do most of the people pay for their own background checks now, or does the organization absorb that cost, or is it everything under the sun?
Ms. Kapanke.
Chairman and Senator Higgins, I used to be a part of a mentor program. I used to help run a program, Mentor Duluth. It's in northern Minnesota. And my understanding is that the majority of the programs, and also through a prevalence survey that our organization did of all the mentor programs in the network, the majority of mentor programs pay out of their operating budget for the background checks. I am not aware of any programs that currently charge their mentors for those background checks. I'm sure there are some, but I'm not aware of any. And the reporting that we received from our mentor programs, we did not get any indication from any of the programs that they charge their mentors. And it makes it hard to do the recruitment process. It's hard to have people give up their free time to mentor, and then on top of that to say, oh, by the way, could you pay for your background check? And that's just the state background check. There are many programs, too, that do federal checks, and those are pretty costly. Through the BCA, that's a $29 charge on top of that $8 charge for the state background check.
I have a question for... A question for Superintendent O'Malley. Is the $8 charge the rock bottom charge that you can do? Or is there an opportunity for the BCA to give a good deal to the mentorship programs?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I think the $8 charge is an indication we are giving them a good deal. It's $15 normally, so it's about half. And the $8, I don't know that that is that prohibitive. I mean, it does add up some. But as the other testifier mentioned, it's really the federal charge that we have no control over. That's $29. So if they're going to do a full-blown fingerprint check and send it to the feds, then we need to. Then it starts adding up a little bit. I think in the one meeting that we had, we talked about. I volunteer too, and at least a couple times a year, I fill it out and send in the form to the BCA to have them do that. And the organizations I work with don't charge me that $8, so they are eating the $8.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to throw out here is a thing that I see is every time something happens, we respond. And background checks may or may not be effective. We really don't know the results of all of these checks that we made. If you're looking at $40,000 worth for this organization, what else are we doing checks on, and how many of them are Minnesota checks and how many are national? And are the Minnesota checks, because they don't have access to the other data that the national one had, are they worth our time? That's what I'm looking for. I'm not sure that we're getting fulfilling a real need by getting these checks.
Senator Olson, do you want to comment or question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question was addressed to the same issue that Senator Foley raised. I'm wondering how often these background checks do reveal people who would be inappropriate to work with children because they don't have a history as a special predator or something like that. How often do you know Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I can only give you the experience, my experience through the Mentor Duluth program when I was part of that program. It came up occasionally, and there are many red flags, not just in background checks, but in the interview process and in references that are checked, and in the private conversation between a professional in counseling or a psychologist between the potential mentor and the potential volunteer. It's hard to tell. I can't give you a number per se, but it does happen. We know that. Even through our national organization, that when they developed a pilot program called the name of the pilot program escapes me, but they did federal checks on mentors, and what they found was that there was a percentage of people who are trying to access volunteer agencies through mentoring organizations, and they were trying to work with kids through these mentoring organizations, and there were some folks who had serious criminal histories, including pedophilia and some other abuse cases. So we know that there are people who are trying to work with kids through systems that they think are easy to get through, faith-based organizations. We see that as well. People think that because they're in a trusted and safe environment and, you know, that they can volunteer with the kids group, and we hear about it in the news. So we know that it happens, but I can't give you an exact number per organization because each organization has different number of mentors.
Superintendent on that.
Mr. Chair and members, I think two quick points. One is I'm confident a deterrent effect to joining us. Those who have something on their record may not apply at all. And then the second thing, and this fits with what she was just talking about, that we have started something at our front desk as a pilot to see the difference between a biometric check and the name and date of birth check, if we actually fingerprint. And we have found that of those who come in to the BCA at the front desk and want to get their criminal history checked, when we fingerprint them versus just run name and date of birth, there's between a 1% and 2% number of those that we would uncover criminal activity that doesn't come by the name and date of birth. So it adds to, if we just do the state check that's name and date of birth, we don't do the fingerprints with the FBI, that costs more, it's going to be a problem. And the last thing I mentioned, and run the risk of aggravating the chair, is that this really comes full circle to some of the CRIMNET stuff with e-charging, even, that is ultimately going to be based on biometrics. I mean, that's really the answer, is where we're going, is that at every stage of the process, with the prosecutor, with the defense attorney, with the courts, with everybody, you're going to put it down, And it's more than just the senior. It's going to pull all this information together and give the right person the right information on the person standing right in front of them.
Thank you for your testimony. I'll represent him.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't sure. Does this only apply to mentoring programs or all volunteers with youth?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulroy, this is just for mentor programs, because we only represent mentor programs.
Senator Neville.
Two questions. First, does the law require that you do these background checks, or are they optional?
Mr. Chair, Senator Neville, it's in statute that the mentor programs have access to the information.
Does the law require you to do background checks for your mentors?
No, it does not.
Okay, and then the second question is, we're also, in fact, both the House and the Senate are funding mentoring programs quite a bit in the corrections budget. What's the difference between the money there and the money here?
Senator Neville, that's different. It's a different.
Isn't that a mentor? It's for
the mentoring program in the Department of Corrections is for children who are
parents are incarcerated.
Parents are incarcerated. Mr. Pinky's organization, the umbrella, is for. Why don't you explain it?
Mr. Chair, the Mentoring Partnership is the umbrella organization for mentor programs. Big Brothers, Big Sisters, I believe, is the maybe the recipient of the Children of Incarcerated Parents money, and that is to serve youth whose parents are incarcerated. So that is direct service. That is a direct service program, and a great program at that. So. We support, and we thank you very much for your support on that particular bill.
Senator Neville.
So that money is not your organization?
No, it is not.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Rosa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pinky. So the Mentoring Partnership of Minnesota is basically the big umbrella that does all the training for all the mentoring programs in the state. Is that correct? Or are there other training programs out there that can take in various different areas of the state, such as the kinship program or... Can you explain that a little bit better? I'm not quite sure on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we are the umbrella organization that provides training, technical assistance, marketing support for the mentor programs, because generally these programs do not have people on staff to do that. So they look to our agency for support in a variety of areas, including public policy. But we do the training, and we hold the statewide conference on mentoring every year for the mentor programs across the state. So we are their state partnership that they look to for training and technical assistance and marketing if they don't have that within their own organization. Some organizations are larger and they have marketing folks and, you know, they have national organizations that they can get support from, like Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and Kinships. But there are a lot of small mentoring programs. We know a majority of mentor programs in this state operate on a budget of $5,000 or less. So there are people wearing several different hats providing different services to kids, and mentoring just happens to be one of them. So,
Mr. Chair, thank you. So this, and I think we did discuss this earlier, Ms. Pinky, but this is strictly for the metro area, and any programs outside of the metro area is somebody's shaking their head in the back there. They would have to supply their own funds for a background check if that's what they so choose.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, if I understand the question correctly, this would be a statewide initiative. So
statewide.
It wouldn't be just for the metro programs. It would be available to any program within our network that goes through a training so that we can identify those programs so that the BCA can do the background checks. And this money goes strictly to the BCA. It does not come to our organization. It goes to the BCA to do the background checks.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Let's move on if there's no other questions for the BCA. We have the fire marshal. This is on page R13. Are there any questions? We have representatives from the fire marshals here. I think we have the exact same... This is the governor's recommendations. So, Harry, can you explain the... the the difference here?
Mr. Chair, members, I think there is a $145,000 difference, and I think one of the reasons for this is this was a change item that the governor came out with. It was somewhat confusing how to mark this on the spreadsheet, and I think I remember I had trouble with this, and I think we were the last ones, but I think the Senate may have double counted their compensation.
Exactly right.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, on the fire marshal, the governor and the House and the Senate have all agreed. The difference on the spreadsheet is the $145,000 that Mr. Carter pointed out that I made a mistake in including in the special revenue account. So, but other than that, we all agree.
Any questions? Okay, then we'll move on. Unless there's the alcohol and gambling enforcement, I believe we've both followed the governor's recommendation here for the biennium. So, Tiger, we do have a slight difference here.
Which Mr. Chair?
R14, the alcohol and gambling enforcement.
Mr. Chair, I think that simply is the compensation adjustment that where you have we have the 2%, you have the 3.25%.
Okay, then are there any questions? Then we'll move on to the subdivision 6, the Office of Justice Program. Senator Higgins,
yep.
This is going to take probably more time than we have today.
I was just going to say, do you want to skip this one and come back to it and go to some of the other ones? Because I know you folks have a time crunch.
Well, I believe the only item that we have left is the 911 emergency services armor. Let's start the Office of Justice Programs then, and Let's look at some of the items here that we have both. We can jump around. We'll jump around here a little bit. We have someone in the audience who probably cannot come back on the youth intervention programs. If you want to briefly, Mr. Anton. If you want to just briefly give a 3 or 4 minute presentation about the research that was done, the cost-benefit analysis of youth intervention programs. That fits nicely into our debate that we had the other day.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Anton. I'm the chief economist for Wilder Research, part of the Wilder Foundation in St. Paul. I conducted research with Professor Judy Temple of the University of Minnesota Humphrey Institute on the return on investment on youth intervention programs and also a companion study on youth mentoring programs. The research that we did looked at the different benefit cost studies and program evaluation studies that had been done on similar types of programs around the country. We interviewed programs in the Youth Intervention Programs Association membership and also in the Mentoring Partnership membership. We looked at the actual cost to their programs and at the perceived benefits. And then We built a framework for analyzing the economic value of the different types of benefits that can be generated by these programs, such as reduced arrest and court costs from reduced juvenile crime and reduced treatment of juvenile offenders, reduced truancy and the effects on high school graduation and school achievement and the economic value of that. Well, we looked at the interdisciplinary research on the effects of these different kinds of policies or these different kinds of outcomes. And then we also looked through the outcomes data that have been collected by the Youth Intervention Partnership Programs Association members on the effect they have on the children that they work with. After we built a framework for doing this analysis, and there's been very little of this sort of research done nationally, we generated reports that actually I have a handout for people to take if they want to, and Scott Beatty from YIPA has copies of the full report. We estimated that, we generated some calculations of the return on investment for a representative type of program, because there haven't been any scientific evaluations of the type where you take two groups of students and one group goes through the program, another doesn't, and you follow them for 5 or 10 years inside of Minnesota. So we took extremely conservative assumptions. For example, if you took 100 children who were diverted from court or recommended from truancy, we assumed that one burglary was avoided out of that group of 100 children from going through this type of program, which is extremely conservative relative to some of the programs that actually have generated such output. When we valued the economic value of these in terms of the future earnings of the children and in terms of the saved court costs, the saved criminal costs, and some other outcomes having to do with health or some other lesser benefits. And by the way, there were benefits that we didn't feel we could evaluate at all at this time. We came up with total benefits in present value terms of $4.89 for every dollar of spending on those programs. In addition, right now, the state of Minnesota grants money to these programs through YIPA, and those state dollars are matched 2-for-1 in local dollars. So if you compare the total benefits generated by this type of program with the state appropriation that goes into the program, on the maintained assumption, I guess, that without that state funding, the program wouldn't exist, then you come up with three times the benefit for each of those state dollars, because they're leveraged by local dollars as well. So if you've seen this report or the executive summary, that means that $14.68 is actually generated in terms of benefit from each dollar that the state appropriates and then is grossed up. And so that's the sort of return that we came up with, and I think that's, as I say, I believe that's conservative based on the difference in our assumptions and the few other studies that have been done. The one way in which this interacts with what you've been doing, and I think you said 3 or 4 minutes, and maybe I'm at 5 now,